The following program is being brought to you on the Voice America Business Channel. For more information about our network and to check our additional show hosts and topics of interest, please visit voiceamericabusiness.com. The Voice America Talk Radio Network is the worldwide leader in live internet talk radio. Visit voiceamerica.com. The views and ideas expressed on the following program are strictly those of the host or guests and do not necessarily reflect the views and ideas held by the Voice America Talk Radio Network, its staff, and management.
For Capital Thinking, where we analyze the key policy, political, legal, and business issues that will shape America's future. Live from Washington, D.C., this is your unfiltered tour of the halls of power. Now, here's your host, Kevin O'Neill.
All right, welcome everybody. Happy Halloween. And there's nothing spookier than what's going on in Washington, D.C. these days and the train wreck that is the federal government on many levels. We're going to talk about some key issues today, none more important than the continuing debacle of the rollout of the healthcare.gov website. Joining us for that conversation, Karen Teal, one of my colleagues, a partner in the Patton Boggs Washington, D.C. office, who spends all of her time advising clients on public policy and healthcare matters. Karen, welcome back. Things have gotten grimmer since last we were together. Let's talk a little bit first about open enrollment and what's going on with the federal and state exchanges that opened on October 1st.
Well, Kevin, the issue has really been the federal exchanges. We hear that for the most part the state exchanges are up running and managing to enroll people. The issue is the federal exchanges, and congressional committees led by House Republicans have been all over this one. It wasn't helpful that the administration took 3 weeks to admit that the issues with the federal exchange were more than just overload issues due to high volume of consumer traffic to healthcare.gov. So last week, House Oversight and Investigation Subcommittee held a hearing with four of the main CMS contractors who testified about what they did, and that revealed that CMS itself had assumed the overall responsibility for what's called systems integration, the end-to-end testing of the system, and we've learned now this week that really was never completed. This week, Congress heard from both the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services Administrator Marilyn Tavenner and the HHS Secretary Kathleen Sebelius herself. They both formally apologized to the American public, but insisted that analyses of the system had been completed, that outside experts had been brought in, the entire system is being tested now end-to-end, and that the federal system would be fixed by the end of November. There were some key decision points that have been revealed in the past week that close to the rollout, the October 1st launch of the system, CMS made three decisions that were not helpful. One was to not allow consumers to browse plans like you would do if you were shopping on the internet for any product before they established an account. They also decided not to ship the applications of those who were found to be eligible for Medicaid upon income verification to the states right away, and not to put up a Spanish version of the system. So CMS is not talking, the secretary won't give any numbers of people who've actually enrolled, but they say they're going to do that by November 15th.
Very good. You know, what you mentioned, the secretary apologized. One of the frustrating things, I think, for so many people in this rollout has been that people say they're responsible, but no one's being held accountable for these failures. Well, let's talk about some of the failures and what they mean policy-wise. I mean, you have all these technical challenges with the website rollout. We're supposed to have all this in place for January 1st, and Republicans have long warned about the individual mandate being unworkable. So what happens if we get to the end of the year and it's looking like that people aren't going to be able to get into the system? Will the mandate go forward, or do you think it'll get delayed?
Well, that's something that's changed this week. Just prior to the congressional hearings this week, consumers were to have had their health insurance in place by February 15th. Remember, it's a six-month initial open enrollment period till the end of March. But to avoid the individual mandate for the 2014 tax year, people would have had to have qualified health insurance in place before February 15th. So earlier this week, Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services issued new guidance that pushes back that date till March 31st to align with the close of the open enrollment period. They do this technically through what's called an additional hardship exemption. That's, you know, one way that the administration moved on this in response to the outcry about the system not working. There's also been a number of bills introduced this past week in Congress that would push that date back even further. And so that's something to watch.
Interesting. Yeah, I suspect the outcry there is only going to get louder. So I know one of the big issues is with the Affordable Care Act implementation has always been you've got to expand Medicaid as part of this. It seems like I've seen news reports that said a lot of what's actually getting through on the Affordable Care Act is not necessarily people finding health plans for themselves as much as finding out that they're eligible for Medicaid. So talk to us a little bit about what's going on with the states and Medicaid in general on this.
That's right. And you'll remember that the Medicaid expansion is a state option. The Supreme Court said it couldn't be a mandatory requirement put on the states. So not all states, only about half the states are expanding Medicaid. What happened was that CMS decided that the federal exchange is not going to ship the applications for those qualifying for Medicaid, either because they truly qualify for traditional Medicaid or the Medicaid expansions, which go up to 138% of the federal poverty level. The date of that CMS is going to take anyone who, by income verification on the federal exchange, qualified for Medicaid and ship those data to the states is tomorrow, November 1st. That is going to be a date to watch. And states that elected to do a Medicaid expansion, if they don't get those Medicaid applications, they're liable to join the chorus of complaints because states are counting on states that elected to do a Medicaid expansion are getting 100% federal funding for those Medicaid expansions for the next few years. So it takes the burden off hospital systems in a state, takes the burden off the state budgets for uncompensated care. So if those data transfers aren't made, that's going to be a problem. And we do know, based on some of the state exchanges, that the bulk of people who are getting enrolled are qualifying for Medicaid. So that is going to be a key date to watch. So three dates in November to watch. Tomorrow, November 1st, do the Medicaid expansion applications get sent to the state Medicaid agencies. November 15th, when Secretary Sebelius said they're going to start talking about the numbers who've actually enrolled, not who filed an application, actually enrolled. And then November 30th, when the exchanges, the functionality of the exchanges are supposed to be fixed.
Karen, one of the other things that I'm seeing a lot of reporting about that I'd love to get your comment on is the worry that seems to be growing amongst the insurance companies that are key players in these marketplaces that you have two problems. One, the rollout of the exchange being botched means that the only people who are really making the effort to get through are the people who are sick and couldn't otherwise be carried under regular insurance conditions, and therefore you may have some significant losses going forward. And B, the push to have the individual mandate delayed would only encourage the healthy and the young to stay out of the risk pool at a time when leading up to when insurance folks have to set their 2015 rates and have them approved by HHS. So give us the perspective on what insurance companies are thinking about the rollout here.
Well, these are two key issues. Insurance is all about two things: a large number of people being insured and spreading the risk. We can't, in the health insurance exchanges, there's no longer any rating based on health conditions. So the only indicator we have of a healthy health condition is for the young adults. They tend to be, clinically, they tend to be a healthy population. They're in large numbers. So to get those young adults enrolled, here I'm talking about people under 30, is really important. And so the insurance companies are nervous. We hear reports that the data that is coming through to the insurance companies on plans people have enrolled in still has problems with it. A week ago, 14 of the major insurance companies went to the White House to complain. They met with Secretary Sebelius, who also assured them this is going to get worked out. But if this system is not completely functional by the end of November, insurance companies are going to be scrambling to get the coverage in place by January 1st. There's also some very troubling polling data that came out this week. NBC News, Wall Street Journal poll. First of all, people are paying attention to this. 83% of those surveyed had heard about problems with the health insurance exchanges, and 6 out of 10 respondents said they'd heard a lot about that. What's happening is now 52% of those surveyed believe that healthcare law needs major overhaul or to be eliminated. And very telling here, the key group that's losing confidence in this is women. About 45% of women think the healthcare law is a bad idea, compared to about 32% who lost confidence in it prior to October. And what's key in here is the moms. If you lose the moms, you're going to lose the young invincibles, the healthy young adults, because it's the moms who are going to be nattering at them to get online and get insurance.
Yeah, let's
if you lose
talk about
the confidence
those.
Of the moms, it's going to hurt.
Let's talk about those moms, Karen. So a lot of moms coming home this month and opening the mail and getting a notice. If they don't have employer-provided coverage, they've been purchasing insurance in the individual marketplace. And across the country, a couple million of them are getting notices from their insurance company saying, we're canceling your plan because it doesn't meet the basic minimums required under the Affordable Care Act. Here are your new alternatives, and at least anecdotally what the media is reporting is those new alternatives are often come at an extraordinary premium over what these folks have been paying. So talk to us about what's happening there and what the policy challenges are from that.
Yeah, when the president said if you like your insurance you can keep it, he probably really should have said if you have really good coverage and a really good plan and like it, you can keep it.
That's not a good soundbite.
Right. It's not a quick, easy soundbite, but that would have been more accurate. What's happening is those individual plans, and it's not just for young adults. There are about 19 million people in the country who have an individual plan. They tended to cost a lot. They tended not to have very good coverage. They tended to have very high deductibles. They tended not to cover all of what the new plans will have as the 10 essential health benefits. And for young adults, many of them are going to qualify for subsidies on the exchange. They're just starting their work lives, their incomes aren't very high, and there are plans that are targeted for young adults that have a high deductible and a fairly low monthly premium. So if young adults, at the prompting of their moms, can get on the plan, get on the website and shop around, they may find plans that are actually cheaper with better coverage than what they've had.
Interesting. Well, I got about 90 seconds left. Karen, give me your prediction on what happens between now and November 30th when the president's team has assured us this website will be operational.
Well, you know, I'm going to go out here on a limb and say I think they're going to pull it off. They've been very behind. It's a scramble, but I think they finally really have spotted the issues and are working around it. You know, whenever you're fixing a set of computer programs, if you patch something, does that interact with something else you patched is going to be an issue. But there's a lot on the line. The president's approval rating is at an all-time low for him, 42%. Republicans who oppose the Affordable Care Act are having a heyday. And the whole credibility of the benefit is riding on getting the system fixed.
Very good. Well, Karen, I think we may have to have you back right around November 30th to see whether or not you've gone out on a limb and it's going to get cut off behind you. We're going to be back in just a minute. Keep it here on Capital Thinking.
Be sure to friend us on Facebook. You can do it right now. Visit Facebook.com/Voice America or search for us at keyword Voice America.
Stay up to date on the latest news out of Washington affecting your business. Check out Patton Boggs' new Capital Thinking blog at capitalthinking.pattonboggs.com. Let one of the world's best legal and political intelligence networks keep you in the loop on the policy developments that matter to you most. Access the network today at capitalthinking.pattonboggs.com. That's capitalthinking.pattonboggs.com.
The following is a paid advertisement from Patton Boggs, LLP.
If you find yourself under the Klieg lights of a government investigation, you want experience on your side. Patton Boggs has 46 years of it. We've handled some of the biggest white-collar crime cases. Put that experience to work for you.
Edward Newberry, attorney at law, is responsible for the content of this ad. Patton Boggs' principal office is located at 2550 M Street Northwest in Washington, D.C., 20037. You may contact Patton Boggs at 202-457-6000. The following is a paid advertisement from Patton Boggs, LLP.
Hear ye, hear ye. The House will come to order.
Having trouble sorting out what's going on Capitol Hill? Patton Boggs can cut through it all. We've got the insight, the know-how, the connections to navigate. Patton Boggs. Straight, unfiltered. Patton Boggs, a bipartisan voice with knowledge and 46 years of experience.
Edward Newberry, attorney at law, is responsible for the content of this ad. Patton Boggs' principal office is located at 2550 M Street Northwest in Washington, D.C., 20037. You may contact Patton Boggs at 202-457-6000.
Voice America Business Network, the bottom line in business.
Live from Washington, it's Capital Thinking with your host, Kevin O'Neill. Join us on the program and weigh in on the topics discussed with your question or comment. The toll-free number is 1-866-472-5790. That's 1-866-472-5790. You can also direct your questions or comments via email to koneill@pattonboggs.com. That's koneill, O-N-E-I-L-L, at pattonboggs.com. Now, back to Capital Thinking.
All right, welcome back. Well, we just talked about health care. One of the other big issues in Washington these days is what's going on with snooping and what's going on with cybersecurity. And joining us to talk about those important issues, Norma Kram, a colleague of mine from the Patton Boggs Washington, D.C. office, where she leads the Homeland Security Defense and Technology Transfer Practice Group. Norma's been closely monitoring cybersecurity. She's been on before talking about that with us, and she's here to update us. Norma, welcome back. I know that NIST, which is the National Institute of Standards and Technology, has been doing some things recently with a draft cybersecurity framework. Tell us a little bit about what's going on there.
Well, thanks, Kevin, and it's great to be back on the show. And as you said, there has been a flurry of activity, really, even in just the last 24 hours, 48 hours. And that's first we saw that the president held a very high-level meeting with a number of core CEOs on this cybersecurity framework. And the revised version of the cybersecurity framework was actually published in the Federal Register just 2 days ago. The thing that's important is that this framework is really the result of many months' worth of work from the administration. It was one of the main deadlines or main projects required in the executive order that was issued nearly 260 days ago. And there were 11 major deadlines in that executive order, and the framework works within that. The biggest thing, of course, is that this is a framework that is supposed to provide best practices, if you will, for every sector. Of course, that's a very hard and challenging thing to do because each of our 16 critical infrastructure sectors are very, very different. And so people have to figure out what this framework will do or not do to help them, quote, raise their cyber hygiene.
Very good. Well, so if I'm a company, why is it important for me to think about the framework and to participate in its development?
You know, that's a really good question. I think a lot of people have been sitting back saying, I don't need to participate. I'm already heavily regulated. You know, I'm good to go. I don't need any more help. But people may have missed the fact that there is a carrot and stick approach in this executive order. The carrot, of course, is that the private sector can help create their own framework for cybersecurity that they can then voluntarily adopt. And the framework, of course, is only as good as what the private sector is providing to them. If folks are suddenly looking up and going, this framework isn't helpful or useful, then folks need to get moving pretty quickly. The stick, if you will, that was included in the executive order as it relates to the framework is if this framework doesn't achieve the goals to fill the gaps and raise cybersecurity health, if you will, across the board, the administration directed all of its regulatory agencies to review their existing regulations and authorities, and for them to report back to the White House to decide whether or not they have what they need. The carrot, of course, is if they decide they don't have the sufficient authority and they report that to the White House and the framework doesn't work, you could see a host of regulations being issued next year. Now, we're not sure about that, but that's the stick in the executive order.
Now, so you talk about sticks. I know one of the things that's been a contention in the past is whether or not this stuff is really voluntary or if it's going to be effectively regulated as a way that you can't avoid these types of things. So talk to us a little bit about that.
Sure. Yeah, that's also a really important issue, too. I mean, people, there's a pro and a con to this strategy. Quote, a voluntary system, one that is created by the private sector, if at the end of the day regulators decide to incorporate in these various requirements, if you're the company that's participated in writing them, then theoretically that's not going to be so much of an issue. The con, of course, is if you are a sector that is not regulated for cybersecurity, if you are a company that has never, maybe small, medium sizes, never had the resources, the voluntary into involuntary is a process that people are concerned about. But I think some have said it's better, you're still better off to have this framework than to have the agencies promulgate new regulations. I think the issue here is that cybersecurity is a core concern. If there is a catastrophic attack on any of these core sectors, there are rippling effects really for our health and well-being as a nation. And the question is, what's the best process to go through to make sure that we're where we need to be?
Interesting. So I got to ask you, obviously tons of news this week about continued snooping and sort of continued drips and drabs from the Snowden grabbing of information from the NSA when he worked there. I'd like to go ahead and just say hello to the NSA. Clearly they're monitoring this phone call. How is that has to have a political impact on everybody that's involved in cybersecurity, right? The thought that Yahoo and Google are now up in arms about it, but more revelations that the government's been building backdoors into their what they thought were highly secure fiber networks, et cetera. Talk to us. What does that all mean?
These are really, really important issues. The debate that's been happening for quite some time, especially on the state of cybersecurity legislation, really revolves around what agency is the appropriate entity to be working with the private sector on cybersecurity issues, on information sharing, and things like that. And there is a very bright line between those who prefer a civilian agency working with them, so that in this case it would be Department of Homeland Security, versus a DOD or an NSA. These are not easy questions to answer, but the more that things come out with Snowden and NSA, I think really hardens those who are very concerned about this overlap into civilian society. And there are some pretty serious privacy issues. So what the administration needs to do, and I think the Congress needs to do, is where they've started, which is taking a very hard look at this. And you have certainly seen Chairman Leahy from the Senate Judiciary Committee and Chairman Sensenbrenner working together to introduce a bill that would rein in NSA's authorities. And I think you're going to see probably quicker movement on bills like that in the short term than on the broader cybersecurity pieces of legislation that folks have been working on for some time.
Interesting. Now, I know there's also an information sharing bill that's out there. What's happening with that?
You know, that has been out there, we say out there, for quite some time. Certainly, as we've all talked about, the House moved their CISPA bill, which included information sharing provisions that were still very controversial and remain so. The Senate has been working on an information sharing bill for some time, but I think that is completely stalled and cannot move forward until the NSA Snowden issues, privacy issues are addressed.
Okay. Well, so we know this final framework is due early next year. I think February. Tell us what you think gets in. What between cybersecurity, data security, privacy protection. What do you think that framework actually looks like?
Sure. Unless we see some momentous shift within the private sector and what they're willing to provide to the administration. I think the framework that you see today is pretty much what you're going to see next February. In the interim, though, as you mentioned, there are bills that deal with privacy issues. There are separate bills for cybercrime, cyber espionage, and data security, and that's just the domestic piece. You have international and negotiations, bilateral, multilateral negotiations on rules of engagement for cybersecurity and data security, and those are huge issues with the EU. But we might see smaller bills, again, cybercrime, cyber espionage, move before the end of the year. And the real question for everyone in the private sector is, what will the administration do, what will the Congress do when this final framework is issued in February of 2014? And it will be at that point, either things could move very quickly, you know, new regulations, new pieces of legislation, or we may all have decided there's a detente, we're good for now, unless, of course, there's a catastrophic cyber attack, and the Congress, probably understandably, will move very quickly to pass a bill that we may or may not like.
Once the horse is out of the barn, Congress is really good at responding.
Yes.
Closing that
right.
door. So let me ask you a little bit different variant of a question we asked earlier. So we asked why companies should care about being involved in the framework, but maybe walk us through the steps you think companies should be taking now, between now and February, to make sure their interests are protected?
Mm-hmm. That's a good question, because I think there's a whole large swath of companies who haven't been focused. So the first thing is that there is a draft out for formal public comment that was issued on October 29th. Comments are due back to NIST by December 13th. I think any company that hasn't participated yet needs to look at those, look at the framework, and provide very specific comments. If you're a heavily regulated sector, then you need to map, if you will, the existing framework to your standards. And even if you're only giving the administration gaps, issues, questions, what have you, those are all incredibly important. There is a specific outreach strategy working with Commerce and the White House and the Department of Homeland Security. Companies need to engage directly with these officials, and people need to think more broadly, even beyond their sector, to understand how you interconnect to other sectors. Where I think there could be gaps that the company should be giving to the administration is, if you rely on three sectors to really operate your business, then you need to look broader beyond yours to figure out, if there was an attack, what would happen. And again, there are a few sectors that are not regulated, and you need to understand who those are and what's happening, because if that framework doesn't acknowledge those issues, there's going to be a serious problem.
Very good. Norma, any sort of wrap-up comments, or you want to tell people how to get in contact with you if they want more information?
Sure. Just one last thought. As people are thinking about cybersecurity, what we continue to say to folks is, if, you know, within your companies, you have different stovepipes. You need to make sure that you're looking at the policy issues we just talked about, legislative issues, but there are legal issues, SEC requirements, standard of care concerns. There are regulatory issues in the Federal Trade Commission's enforcement of consumer rights. You need to put together a holistic risk management strategy for your company. Otherwise, your stovepipes will really prevent you, I think, from fully understanding what the gaps and the impacts are in your company. So I can be reached at Patton Boggs. That was ncraham@pattonboggs.com. And would look forward to talking to anyone who needs some further information.
Excellent. We're going to come right back and talk to America's favorite law dean about trends in legal education. You're listening to Capital Thinking. Keep it here.
Which guests are being featured this week. Read our network press releases and read the blog posts from your favorite hosts. Go to iradioblog.com today, powered by the Voice America Talk Radio Network.
The following is a paid advertisement from Patton Boggs, LLP.
Hola.
Konnichiwa.
Bonjour.
Hello.
From Anchorage to Abu Dhabi.
Markaba.
From Denver to Doha.
Ciao.
Patton Boggs makes business transactions the world over.
Oi.
Rely on our insights for your next deal. Patton Boggs, the international business team. Straight, unfiltered, Patton Boggs.
Edward Newberry, attorney at law, is responsible for the content of this ad. Patton Boggs' principal office is located at 2550 M Street Northwest in Washington, D.C., 20037. You may contact Patton Boggs at 202-457-6000.
Stay up to date on the latest news out of Washington affecting your business. Check out Patton Boggs' new Capital Thinking blog at capitalthinking.pattonboggs.com. Let one of the world's best legal and political intelligence networks keep you in the loop on the policy developments that matter to you most. Access the network today at capitalthinking.pattonboggs.com. That's capitalthinking.pattonboggs.com.
The following is a paid advertisement from Patton Boggs, LLP.
The same firm that's been navigating the government maze for more than four decades is also the same firm that can help you protect your most important assets. Whether it's a valuable patent, an important copyright, or your next big idea, Patton Boggs is committed to protecting your intellectual property.
Edward Newberry, attorney at law, is responsible for the content of this ad. Patton Boggs' principal office is located at 2550 M Street Northwest in Washington, D.C., 20037. You may contact Patton Boggs at 202-457-6000.
When it comes to business, you'll find the experts here. Voice America Business Network. From Washington, it's Capital Thinking with your host, Kevin O'Neill. Join us on the program and weigh in on the topics discussed with your question or comment. The toll-free number is 1-866-472-5790. That's 1-866-472-5790. You can also direct your questions or comments via email to koneill@pattonboggs.com. That's koneill, O-N-E-I-L-L, at pattonboggs.com. Now, back to Capital Thinking.
All right, welcome back. We are joined by Nick Allard, one of the people with a more unique perspective on the world of legal education and the practice of law. 17 months ago tomorrow, Nick Allard became the eighth dean of Brooklyn Law School, and he's helping spearhead changes and creating innovative legal education there at Brooklyn. But he's also kept a foot firmly planted in the practice of real law, where he continues to be a co-chair of the government advocacy practice here at Patton Boggs in Washington, D.C., and has formerly been the co-chair of the world's largest public policy department here. So, Nick, welcome back. I want you to maybe catch our listeners up to some of the writing and some of the trends that you see, what's happening in how the practice of law is changing and what you're doing to adapt in teaching the next generation of lawyers.
Well, the world of law is definitely changed, and our graduates are facing a legal profession, a practice of law that will be very much unlike what has proceeded in the past. And one of the things we've done is listen. I think it's useful that I've had a foot in practice, and increasingly new law school deans, more and more of them have private practice experience and even retain some of that experience and connection. But we've been listening very carefully to employers, and we're listening to potential students to see what their concerns are and needs, and we're talking with our students about what they need in the job market. And so what we've concluded is that the changes that are going on are transformational. You know, the law is now increasingly global. Borders and local law are less relevant than they've ever been before. Technology has transformed law. And also we have the phenomena, which was accelerated by the economic downturn and the lingering downturn, is that everyone wants more for less. And so that is coupled, and on top of the fact that there's brand new practice areas, there's a tremendous demand for lawyers, but not in the areas or doing the things that they used to do. And so it's important to kind of figure out where are the new growth areas and what do lawyers do in those new areas, so that we can prepare at Brooklyn Law School prepare students for jobs where they will be, not where they were. You know, like Wayne Gretzky always said, skate to where the puck is going, not to where it was.
Yeah, and I know one of the things you've written about is that, you know, the key buzzwords of the future for legal education are regulatory and compliance. You want to talk about those trends?
Well, there's several areas that are growth areas and where a new lawyer can get started and have a career as a leader in that career for the next 30 or 40 years. Health, energy, internet law, privacy is a tremendous area, but certainly compliance and regulation are at the top of the list. The amount of opportunity, the amount of demand for good lawyers in the field of compliance is astonishing. In the last couple of weeks, I've received phone calls, one from a major bank indicating they immediately needed 250 new lawyers. Another from a placement firm is looking for 50 new lawyers who they plan to train. Last night at the law school, we had a program on Foreign Corrupt Practices Act led by leading lawyers at Goldman Sachs, and other downtown law firms who work in the finance area, and all these folks were former assistant U.S. attorneys in New York in the Southern District, and every one of them said that the amount of compliance and regulatory work across substantive areas is astonishing. And they said, one of them said, sort of on cue, if there's any student who speaks Chinese, I'll hire them on the spot. Just hand me the resume up here. We need somebody to do some compliance work involving Chinese issues. It's remarkable.
Well, so Nick, I know one of the innovative things you're doing is really changing what has traditionally been a three-year march through law school to provide the timeline that people need, be it faster or slower. I think it's called 2-3-4. But walk us through what the Brooklyn 2-3-4 program is all about.
Sure. One of the things I learned in private practice representing clients on Capitol Hill was that offering consumers choice is always a good thing, and that you empower them and you don't have to stuff down their throats one particular product or service. You know, let them choose what best suits them. At Brooklyn Law School, we've listened, we've done some extensive market research, and we found, and I'm going to summarize, give you the high notes on this. 65% of a very large amount of people we surveyed indicated they'd be interested in earning their JD in a shorter period of time, interested in a two-year JD. And if, and here's the big if it would be the same quality, and if it would prepare them well for practice. And so what we've done at Brooklyn Law School is not what you often hear when people are talking about a two-year JD or criticizing a two-year JD. We are offering students the ability to choose their path and the time they earn their JD. They can get through in 24 months, and that's an accelerated two-year JD, the standard three-year JD, or the four-year extended JD, including a lot of night classes for people. Now, you get to choose, and you have the ability to move back and forth between those if it turns out that, you know, you have changes in your life, or you need some extra time, or maybe you get a great job in your second year. You want to work at that job while you're going to school and slow down a little bit. But we're making sure that it's transparent to an employer. If a student has a JD, whether it's 2, 3, or 4 from Brooklyn Law School, it's the same quality. So the two-year program is the full 85 ABA-approved program, and involving the same experiences and the same training. We're looking for, if that is not for everybody, and for plenty of people, they'd rather go through in 3 years or longer, they'd rather have more time for more scholarly work, maybe participate on a law review as an editor-in-chief or something. But for those who, we think there's a large number of people who have not only motivation, but some life experience and maturity, it's very attractive for them to be able to complete their law school work in 2 years.
Interesting. Well, so what are some of the inefficiencies you got to wring out of the system in order to get 3 years condensed into 2 years? And you said it's not for everyone, so who are the people best situated to take it?
Well, I'll answer that part first. We're expecting that people who have already had some job experiences, people who have an MBA or a CPA, or maybe a PhD, and they think that a JD is an enhancement to their career, For example, many of these compliance jobs in finance areas say JD preferred, so that could be an enhancement, or it could be a career change for those people. We also know that this is going, well, because we've already heard from people, we know that people returning to the workforce after raising families, people from overseas, international lawyers who maybe have an extensive practice looking ahead in the United States, find that a U.S. two-year JD is preferable to a one-year LLM, and also people who completed their military service. I spoke to a captain in Afghanistan who was asking about our two-year JD, and I asked him, how long have you been in Afghanistan? And he said, 3 years. I said, well, you know what? 2 years in Brooklyn, 3 years in Afghanistan, I think you can handle it. So we're very excited about the people who will be looking. Now, the efficiencies you asked about, the two-year program, you start in May, you work through the summer, and when I say work, I mean you go to class. And so you start in May, and you earn a significant number of credits that first summer, then you go immediately into the regular curriculum in the fall and the spring. You also earn credits in the intersession, and then you pick up again and work, earn 11 credits in the summer after your first year, and then you go right on and complete by the following May. So it's 24 months, and you're basically working during intersessions and summer vacations as a student in law school. And so for some people, that's too much of a pace, and it's not the pace that they prefer. But we believe that some people will be very much attracted to being able to complete their JD work, and they have the support around them to do it in 24 months.
So, Nick, you mentioned the veteran coming back from abroad. So is that a target audience for you, and are you doing anything special, providing additional financial assistance or adjusting to getting back into academic mode for those great veterans who are returning from the war on terror abroad?
Oh, that's a great question, and thanks for asking. First of all, the first thing the captain asked me was, do we take the 9/11 GI Bill? And yes, we do. But in addition, we offer extremely generous financial aid at this law school, extremely generous. And our two-year JD students are eligible for the same aid packages. And in fact, because they're going to be highly accomplished students, you know, it's more like a Navy SEALs program. It's not a shortcut. They will probably be getting a disproportionate amount of financial aid. So I think that it's, you know, some law schools have talked about a two-year JD and cutting the tuition for it. Our approach is a little bit different. It's the same per-credit tuition because you're getting the same degree. But on the other hand, the amount that you actually pay is going to be substantially reduced because you'll be eligible for very large financial aid packages. And veterans will certainly be at the top of the list.
Nick, I had seen some reports that show that the number of people taking LSATs is still down and the number of people attending lots of law fairs are down. You're obviously doing things like this to make legal education more attractive to folks. But talk to us about what else law schools have to do and what do students have to think through in this market to make sure this is the right choice for them.
Well, at the risk of sounding like that crazy Colonel Kilgore in Apocalypse Now, I love the smell of napalm in the morning. I've been telling everybody two things. One, this is the greatest time in recent history to apply to law school because those numbers are down. And it's also a time when there's a shortage of lawyers already in key sectors. And in 5 years, you're going to be hearing people, I'm the first person that's really saying this very much, but you'll be hearing people complain about the shortage of well-trained lawyers. So I think it's a time of great opportunity. If you apply to law school now, your chances of being admitted to a top school like Brooklyn Law School are greatly enhanced. Just there's fewer people applying. We are very, very happy to see the number of people who are attracted here. We're one of very few law schools in the country that this year has an entering class that's slightly larger than the class the year before. In other words, even though we had far fewer applications, we didn't sacrifice our standards, but we got more people deciding to come here. I think it's in part a tribute to our financial aid packages and the offerings that we have. But I think that students need to know that they want to go to law school. They need to be optimistic and confident that there will always be a role for lawyers. And, you know, I'd buy low, sell high. I'd come in now to law school, and it's a great, honorable career. You'll be well prepared to make a big difference in our society, and it's a great profession. So now's the time to come to law school.
Well, with that, Dean Allard, let me ask you to hit people with contact info if they want to learn more about the Brooklyn Law School and the 234 program you have going.
Well, the best place to do is just go to our Brooklyn Law School website. If you just plug into a search engine, Brooklyn Law School, that'll come up, and right on that website there's information. And also, if that doesn't get it, feel free to call me directly at 718-780-7902. And just call the Brooklyn Law School, and I'm happy to hook you up, especially if you're interested in the two-year JD.
Great. Well, we've been talking with Dean Nick Allard about how to get in law school, how to succeed there. We're about to talk with Cordell Parvin about how to be a successful lawyer and get coached up to be the best in the business. We'll do that right after this commercial break.
Your favorite Voice America Talk Radio Network shows and hosts are in your car, outdoors, and wherever you need them to be.
Listen anywhere.
Get our mobile app for iPhone, BlackBerry, or Android at the Apple iTunes App Store, BlackBerry App World, or Android Market.
The following is a paid advertisement from Patton Boggs, LLP.
Hear ye, hear ye. The House will come to order.
Having trouble sorting out what's going on Capitol Hill? Patton Boggs can cut through it all. We've got the insight, the know-how, the connections to navigate. Patton Boggs. Straight, unfiltered. Patton Boggs, a bipartisan voice with knowledge and 46 years of experience.
Edward Newberry, attorney at law, is responsible for the content of this ad. Patton Boggs' principal office is located at 2550 M Street Northwest in Washington, D.C., 20037. You may contact Patton Boggs at 202-457-6000. The following is a paid advertisement from Patton Boggs, LLP.
Interrogatories.
Prima facie.
Pleadings.
Motion for summary judgment.
E-discovery.
Affirmative defense.
Stipulations.
Ex parte.
Amicus brief.
Subpoena.
Litigation is confusing. Trust the litigation team at Patton Boggs to make sense of it all.
Edward Newberry, attorney at law, is responsible for the content of this ad. Patton Boggs' principal office is located at 2550 M Street Northwest in Washington, D.C., 20037. You may contact Patton Boggs at 202-457-6000. The following is a paid advertisement from Patton Boggs, LLP.
From K Street to Wall Street to LaSalle Street, the Patton Boggs team knows how to pull off big business transactions. Come hear what we know. Patton Boggs covers the world.
Edward Newberry, attorney at law, is responsible for the content of this ad. Patton Boggs' principal office is located at 2550 M Street Northwest in Washington, D.C., 20037. You may contact Patton Boggs at 202-457-6000.
When it comes to business, you'll find the experts here. Voice America Business Network. Washington. It's Capital Thinking with your host, Kevin O'Neill. Join us on the program and weigh in on the topics discussed with your question or comment. The toll-free number is 1-866-472-5790. That's 1-866-472-5790. You can also direct your questions or comments via email to koneill@pattonboggs.com. That's koneill, O-N-E-I-L-L, at pattonboggs.com. Now, back to Capital Thinking.
All right, welcome back to Capital Thinking. Well, we were talking about law school. Now we're going to talk about what to do to be successful in your legal career after you get out of school. Joining us is Cordell Parvin, one of the nation's most influential coaches of lawyers across the country. He works with lawyers in a variety of contexts, everything from big firms to solo practitioners, helping them develop and focus their work and get that work-life balance. So, Cordell, a place to start. I know we didn't get a chance to ask Dean Allard this, but one of the things they don't really teach in law school is how to actually run the business side of a law practice, whether or not it's you and me in a two-man shop or you and me as partners inside a behemoth with a couple thousand lawyers. So talk to us about how a lawyer, in the midst of all the work they have to do, gets the skills to develop the business sense needed to succeed.
Well, Kevin, before we start, I want to just congratulate you. The Hill newspaper yesterday named you one of the top lobbyists, one of the top 50, and that's just a huge honor and well deserved. So I just want to make sure your listeners are aware of that honor that has been bestowed on you. So, congratulations.
I appreciate that. So tell me about
the business side. The interesting thing now is that the internet provides so many opportunities for online learning, and for example, I'm in my next life. I'm currently on my second one with doing the coaching. In my third career, I'm going to write novels. Well, as you may be aware, there are many online creative writing courses out there. So the internet, including iTunes, has all these courses from colleges across the country. So that's one way to learn the business. I think it's really important that lawyers understand the business of their clients as well as understanding business more generally. And as you're probably aware, on your iPad, among other places, there are plenty of apps that are available that you can focus on in industry. So, for example, on Flipboard or on Zite, when I was a construction lawyer, if I still was doing that, I can have all this news coming in related to construction. So, today, one thing that's going to set young lawyers apart from others is understanding the business of their clients. Clients expect it, they want it, they demand it, actually, so that's a good starting point.
Interesting. Okay, that's very helpful to know. So you often talk about people having sort of a toolkit that they can use to advance their career. What do you see as the necessary elements, much like a screwdriver and a hammer? What are the things I need to have in my toolkit?
Well, I think it begins with having a plan. I'm always shocked. I go to speak at law firm retreats frequently, as you are aware, and I'll ask the audience, how many of you in the audience have a business plan for the year? And I'm frequently surprised at the very small percentage that have a plan. And then I ask, how many belong to Costco? And then I ask, do you ever go to Costco without a list? The most important assets a lawyer has is time and energy. So the starting point is a plan. Once you have the plan, and once you are basing your plan on what your strengths are, then you're going to figure out the tools. But tools include your law firm bio. What's on your bio? Tools include things like writing articles, getting public speaking opportunities, doing blogging, doing webinars. And again, the tools that I mentioned for the iPad are great tools for bringing information to you so that you'll have a good source to be writing articles or blog posts or giving presentations. I actually have a blog, and if any listeners interested, I'll be happy to share a blog that lists about 25 different tools for the toolkit.
Very good. All right. Well, so let's go to the other big thing I know you focus on, which are sort of the key qualities that people need to have or develop in order to make sure that they reach their potential in the legal world.
To me, it's more than anything else. I was asked that when I was practicing law, and our person responsible for HR said, "What is the characteristic of an outstanding associate?" And to me, it's having this burning desire to keep learning and to get better, and having an open mind to new ideas. I'm doing a blog post tomorrow, and the title of it will be that what you learn when you think you know everything is the most important. And so if you look at the most outstanding lawyers in your firm and elsewhere, they are constantly learning, and they're adjusting to the new environment. Nick earlier mentioned how the law of practice has been transformed perhaps forever. Well, the lawyers who are going to be successful are embracing the change rather than resisting it and figuring out how to survive and do well and thrive in the new environment. So I would say the intellectual curiosity, the burning desire to become the best that they can possibly be, and having an open mind of how it's going to work to get there.
So we talked to Dean Allard in the last segment about trends in legal education. Talk to us about your sense of where the future is headed just for the practice of law in 2014 and beyond.
I think that lawyers are going to become more focused on niche practice areas. And it could be industry-based. I have always felt that law firms should do marketing based on not what lawyers do, but what their clients do. So earlier you had Karen on with the healthcare. So, you know, healthcare is an industry. My old practice area, construction, is an industry. Cybersecurity is becoming an industry, which crosses actually several industries. So I think that people are going to expect their lawyers to be, you know, top of the line and knowledgeable in those areas. I feel like litigation is going down because the cost is so incredibly expensive to litigate any type of matter. And so I think being able to be known as someone who resolves disputes, you know, so alternative dispute resolution, I think that's going to become an important area. But I think two important things, lawyers, young lawyers in particular, the things to focus on are building your profile, which includes things like writing, speaking, it could be being active in the bar, it could be a variety of other things, and then building relationships. I coached a lawyer one time that when he was literally a first-year lawyer, wrote the names of 50 people he thought were going to be successful, who he knew, down on a sheet of paper, and then made a purposeful effort to stay in touch with those people over the years and build those relationships. So relationship building is important. You know, another trend is social media. I think lawyers need to know how to use LinkedIn effectively, need to know how to use Twitter effectively. I think most lawyers don't use Facebook other than, you know, personal relationships, but, you know, people need to know that tool as well, and there are a variety of other ones that are coming in the forefront.
Nice. Well, Cordell, we got enough time for you to direct people to your website if they want more info.
Well, actually, my blog would be the best place to go. It's Cordell with two L's blog.com. You can do a search there of a variety of different topics. I've actually, as you know, Kevin, interviewed you on how you do your business plan. So you're actually on the blog as well.
Well, they should visit anyway. Well, great, Cordell. Enjoyed having you on the show. Folks, have a great and safe Halloween, and we'll be back next week with more Capital Thinking.
Thank you for joining us for Capital Thinking with your host, Kevin O'Neill. We hope to have you join us again for more insight from Washington. We're here every Thursday at 9 a.m. Pacific Time, noon Eastern, on the Voice America Business Network.
Thanks again for listening to the preceding program brought to you on the Voice America Business Channel. For more information about our network and to check out additional show hosts and topics of interest, please visit voiceamericabusiness.com. The Voice America Talk Radio Network is the worldwide leader in live Internet talk radio. Visit voiceamerica.com. The views and ideas expressed on the preceding program are strictly those of the host or guests and do not necessarily reflect the views and ideas held by the Voice America Talk Radio Network, its staff, and management.